it's working in there. So, talked a little bit about last week already, and now we're ready for lesson 22. I want to just ask you guys a couple questions here about God delivering the Egyptians, or delivering the Israelites out of the Egyptians' hands last week. And the question that they're asking here of us is, when God brought his people out of Egypt, to whom was he showing his mighty power? Who would he be showing his mighty power to?
Well, Egypt was a pretty powerful country at that time. He's really going to be showing it to everybody.
Uh-huh.
Maybe primarily Israelites.
Yeah, the Israelites. He was showing it to Israelites. The Egyptians obviously saw his power. But it also says that he showed his power so that all the nations around would know. And we're going to see that as we get into this lesson here when we get ready to pursue. So, what was the other thing that God fulfilled when Israel headed out the land of Egypt?
His promise to Abraham.
His promise to Abraham. His promise to Abraham was that the children of Israel were going to be captive in a foreign land for 400 years. And at the end of 400 years, he would deliver them, right? And so, by them moving out, they're fulfilled out. The other thing is that God was going to lead them into a land flowing with milk and honey, right? And their descendants, all the descendants of Israel, would inherit this land. Why did the deliverer have to come through the Israelites?
The blessing went through the Israelites.
The blessing, or that was God's promise that to Abraham that, hey, I will send a deliverer and he will come through your line, through your family.
That was his covenant.
That was his covenant, right. And so if God said that, set that covenant up with Abraham 400 years prior, or a little more than 400 years prior to that, God's not going to change and say, well, now I want the deliverer to come through the Egyptian line, right? He's going to continue to bring the deliverer through the line of Israel. Even though sometimes it doesn't seem like it's going to be possible that that's going to take place. So that brings us all the way to Exodus 13. It seems like, you know, we've been 22 weeks and we're only to Exodus 13. That's just a lot of time to spend in those first few chapters of the Bible. And from now on, we'll start going through it fairly quickly as we get through the timeline, because we don't cover every single story or piece of history that is there. So Exodus 13, verses 17 through 18, and let's read. Someone read that.
Then it came to pass, when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, lest perhaps the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by way of the wilderness of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel went up in early, orderly ranks out of the land of Egypt.
So, it says here that God... Now, wait a minute. That doesn't sound right. Hold on a second. You mean to tell me that God's going to take people, his people, who's just delivered from Egypt, instead of putting them right on a straight path to the land of Canaan, he's going to now what? What did it say he was going to do?
Lead them by... God led the people around the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea.
All right, so I'm going to skip forward to the map here. We'll go back. So here we are in Egypt. And he leads them into a wilderness. Why do you think God did that? What was the reason that he did?
He wanted to test them.
He wanted to test them?
I don't know.
Well,
it would be easier. It would be easier if they got into hard times if they went the short way to go back.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the short way to go back, yeah.
Maybe protect them too.
Yeah. One of the other things is that if they ran into battles along the way with people, they might change their mind. How many times,
I just had this happen to me. What's today? Thursday? Just happened. I had this happen to me on Tuesday of this week. A situation at work that I came home and I really wanted to give up. I wanted to tell Lynn, here's my 2 weeks' notice. I'm done. I'm done. I'm done leading. I'm done leading. I can't handle this. This is just too much for me. I'm saying, what in the world are you talking about? Well, that happens. It was so easy. It was a small situation. But, you know, I don't need to deal with this. I can do something else. I can deal with all this mess. That's what he was trying to keep the Israelites from having. When you run into a battle, you immediately, I'll give up. I'll just turn right around and go back to Egypt. I don't have any battles. I'll be in slavery. So he didn't want the children of Israel to, as soon as he runs into a battle, let me skip back here to where we're at. That way we can do that. So God led them into the desert, not the shortest route through the promised land, so that if the people faced a battle, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. Okay? So he wanted to do that. Now you got to remember, there is approximately, we don't know the exact number, but the Bible tells us there were 600,000 men. So, and that would have been men of fighting age, men who were equipped or strong enough for war or for battle. So we have at least a 600,000 man army, not counting the older generation or women and children. So if you figure if every strong man was married and had at least one child, and you have your wife, that's 1.2 million plus another 600, 1.8 million people that left Egypt if they each had one child. Now, odds are that I had more than that, and some people weren't married, some would have been married. But they would have had this thing. So some estimates, people, these are some of the things here. Of the 12 tribes that left, some people have estimated there would have been 2.5 million people leaving Egypt. Now, again, you can't prove that, but again, that's how they run their numbers. So you kind of give that kind of a picture in your mind of 2.5 million people, which I think the state of Delaware is not even a million. It might be a little over a million people now. Years ago, it was only like 800,000. But so I figure all the people within the state of Delaware leaving Delaware, walking to New York City or something. Do you know what I mean? Okay? That's what it would have been like with animals, livestock. How fast do you think they moved? It would have taken them a while to get there, right? And they were not going to move, you know, 10 miles an hour or something like that. Yeah, you had to get to figure all that, the livestock and everything for grazing as they went along. They had to stop the watering of that. I mean, just a massive. And Moses was put in charge of organizing that leadership when they let him out. Amazing thing. 12 tribes of people. These were all the members, the names of all the sons of Jacob, and those were the tribes. Those were the things. So God then he guides his people with a pillar of cloud. Let's read what it says here, 21 through 22.
And the Lord went before them by day, a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night a pillar of fire to give them light, so as to go by day and night. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night before the people.
Okay, so you have this picture now. Here's God. Remember in the burning bush when God met with Moses. And you have this picture of 2 million. Let's just stick with the numbers that they come up with. 2.5 million people. And out in the front is a cloud not like that sits up in the sky. It says a pillar of cloud. So I picture a pillar. A cloud in the shape of a pillar, just straight up and down. So instead of a cloud in the sky like we see today, this cloud turns and just goes vertical. And it's moving along in front of them, kind of keeping pace. Now, the way it's reading here, it reads like they don't stop. It reads as if they keep traveling all night long as well. I had to process that as I'm thinking about that. How would you keep moving 2.5 million people along the road all the time? But it kind of gives the impression that at night they're also traveling. You know, they're traveling at night, some are traveling during the day. I don't know if they went in shifts, go 10 miles, take a rest, next, I don't, whatever. But they move along and they're going through. The other thing that this leaves an impression of, or when you have 2.5 million people moving, you leave a trail. You think about it, if we had 2.5 million people traveling from Dover to New York, what would you see along the road today? Trash. I get tired of carrying this, so I throw it to the side and someone else picks it up or something like that, right? We would see that. I don't know if they littered back then, but we have people moving stuff along, and so they leave a trail. It's not like they can cover their tracks behind them, right? So skip down all the way to now chapter 14, and let's see what happens. Verses 1 and 2.
Then the Lord said to Moses, tell the Israelites to turn back and encamp near Baal Horeb, between Migdol and the sea. They are encamped by the sea, directly opposite Baal Zephon.
Okay, so the Lord then gives instructions to Moses and tells him to go turn back and camp along the sea there, get across, camp along the shore, cross from that. So we get that. Let's go to the map here and kind of see where they were at.
So they backtracked.
So, yeah, right. They kind of backtracked. So they came down here along the wilderness. Instead of going straight out into the land where God had promised them, all right, the land of Canaan over here. So there's the land of Canaan. You could have went to Egypt right straight to the land of Canaan, right? Instead of that, God led them all the way down to the wilderness this direction. And now they're at the Red Sea. Okay? And you have, notice there's two Mount Sinai's here. And I tried to do some research a while back. I was telling you about the mountain that is burned on the top. Mm-hmm. And I could not find that. They have kind of pulled them pictures off the internet. This was years ago. There was a mountain that you weren't forbidden to go on in Saudi Arabia. You're not allowed to go on the, which is what they believe is right here. Some of them believe that's the mountain that God, the whole entire top is charred. It's all black. And they've got it fenced off. The Saudi Arabian government will not let you go into it, onto this mountain. And there's a lot of speculation. Is that the mountain that God came down and met? Because when we get to where he releases the Ten Commandments, we have that the top of the mountain was full of smoke and thunder and lightnings and blackened because of God's presence being there. And so we have these two locations where some are saying the traditional location, which is everybody believes is here, and some say this mountain over here could be. Regardless of the fact, God leads the children of Egypt down here, and they're going to cross either here to here and then go up into Canaan, or they're going to cross this Red Sea and go up into Canaan. Okay, so that's where they're at this point. They're camped right here along the Red Sea. All right, verses 5 through 7. Let's see what happens.
When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his officials changed their minds about them and said, "What have we done? We have let the Israelites go and have lost our services. So he had his chariot made ready and took his army with him. He took 600 of the best chariots along with all the other chariots of Egypt, with officers all over them. Excuse me, the lightning's
coming. Oh, you're good. All right, so all of a sudden it's like they wake up from their decision of letting the Israelites leave. Oh, I'm sorry, wait a minute, we just lost all our slaves. We can't do anything. So they get up and get ready to head out, and they make a decision that we're going to go capture them, and so they get on the chariots. Now, he said the best chariots. So they obviously had different grades of chariots, and they bring them all, and here all of a sudden he's going along, and who all of a sudden changes Pharaoh's mind? Who was guiding Pharaoh's thoughts at this time?
Well, in verse 4 it says he hardens his heart.
Ah, he hardens his heart. So, is it God that... So God would cause Pharaoh to...
want to go get the children of Israel and bring them back to Egypt?
Seems to be that's what he says.
Seems to be that what he says. Okay. And Satan wouldn't have anything to do with it?
It's not scripted here.
Doesn't say Satan, right? Doesn't say Satan. Doesn't say that it was Satan who does that. But we know that Satan wants to destroy the children of Israel, right? And why does he want to destroy the children of Israel? Because the deliverer is coming through that. We don't know who the deliverer is.
Yeah,
you're right. We've all slipped up. We don't know who the deliverer is yet, but the deliverer is to come through the line of Israel. And so Satan is out to destroy Israel. And you will see this over and over again throughout the whole Old Testament, that he does not want Israel to tell the children of Israel to live.
So, after all the plagues and everything, Pharaoh's just going to change his mind like that. Like, he's going to want that to come back to him after all that God did to him?
It seems to be that, yeah, after all the plagues, he's lost his firstborn, all of the Egyptians, you know, I can't imagine the cry that would have went up during that.
Because you've got to imagine what the city looked like. It was vacant. It was empty. It was, you know, it was dead.
Yeah.
Except for the masters that live there.
And here we are now to where we're ready to have the them chase afterwards. I would come back to that. They actually skip down past verse 8 and jump to verse 10, Michael. But we can talk about that a little bit. It says, the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh and the king of Egypt. When the scriptures say that the Lord hardened, it gives the impression that God will, that gives the impression, the way I read that, sometimes means that I would say that, is it possible for God to say, okay, I want Michael's heart to be hardened towards me? Does that match the character of God that we've been studying throughout the first part? It doesn't. That does not match up. But it's in the Bible. So if it's in the Bible, it's truth.
It seems to be that he's making something good out of it.
So
the other nations know that I am the Lord.
Ah, yeah, we skipped over that verse, didn't we? We didn't have that verse to read. Right, verse 4 comes back. It says, and then I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will chase after you. He tells that to Moses. He actually says that to Moses. Now, you imagine Moses. Do you think Moses got in front of all the people and said, wait a minute, Pharaoh and his army is coming to get you? Moses didn't do that, but God revealed that to Moses, right? And he said that, I'm going to allow him because I want my name to be known. I want the whole world to know about what we have done here.
Because he's going to be doing something greater later on.
Mm-hmm. So I want the whole world to know that and that my glory through Pharaoh and his arm, I'm going to get glory out of this situation. Now, so let's just stick with that a little bit. Let's just leave it right there, and we'll keep right on going. So verse 10 and 10 through 12 says this, and then as Pharaoh approached, the people of Israel looked up and panicked when they saw all the Egyptians overtaking them. They cried out to the Lord, and they said to Moses, why did you bring us out here to die in the wilderness? Weren't there enough graves for us in Egypt? What have you done to us? Why did you make us leave Egypt? Now, didn't we tell you this would happen while we were still in Egypt? We said, leave us alone. Let us be slaves in Egypt. It is better to be a slave in Egypt than a corpse in the wilderness or to die in the wilderness. Now, you've got to... I don't know what goes through your mind when you read those verses, but for me, here he is. Moses argued with God at the bush, said, I don't want to do this. God says, yes, you're my man. I want you to do this. Moses then agrees to go to deliver the children of Israel out. They come out of the land of Egypt, and now he's sitting there with 2.5 million people in an angry uproar, ready to charge him, get rid of him, because he brought him out into the wilderness. Now, it doesn't say in the scriptures that they said, well, why didn't you take us around the easy way? Says they, why did you bring us into the wilderness? You know, sometimes, and there's a good sermon right in this, sometimes we want to stay in the wilderness and we just
We want to go back and be a slave to the things that we once did way back in our past that God has freed us from through the deliverer. We want to go back to that over and over again. And here the children of Israel are doing the same thing. Oh, I'd rather go back and be a slave than be free. And so you have that, and they're afraid. So why were they afraid? If they were willing to go back and be a slave, why were they afraid of the Egyptians?
They would be punished.
Be punished? Well, I could see that, be punished, but I think more so they were afraid that they were going to get killed.
That's what I got.
Yeah. I think they were afraid that they're going to kill us for leaving. Even though the Egyptians said, go ahead and go.
Right. That they would come up with something, you know, the secondborn would be killed of every family or whatever.
Yeah. And that's a key principle there, that oftentimes when we become afraid of something, we often tend to revert back to what we were a slave to. And whatever it would be. Moses trusted the Lord, though, and told the Israelites to believe in God, right? Well, let's see what he says. 13 through 14. Someone grab 13 through 14.
And Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more. And the Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace.
Okay, so Moses, this is Moses' response. 2.5 million people angry at Moses. I'm saying 2.5 million people. I don't know how many people were shouting, but you got Moses standing here in front of the people, and they're yelling at him, take us back. I want to go back to be a slave in Egypt. And Moses' response was, don't be afraid, stand still and see the power of the Lord. He's going to rescue you. Watch and see what God does to save you. Now, Moses doesn't know that God's going to split the Red Sea at this point, right? He's not. He doesn't know that. But he says, stand still, watch and see. That's pretty bold words that Moses had. What did he have to back on that? What kind of backing did Moses have to be able to stand in front of 2.5 million? That'd be like me standing up in church on Sunday morning and saying, all right, church, it's rough times out here. The state has just authorized. They're going to come in and shut us down as a church. And there, anybody that's caught in the church has to either, if they want to stay alive, has to deny Jesus, deny the deliverer, and walk out the back door, and you will live. If you stay here within the church and accept and say the deliverer is who he says he is, your life is going to be taken. That's the kind of that's what they're up against, a predicament. They're stuck up against that wall of sea, can't go anywhere, and here comes the Egyptian armor, and Moses, and I stand in front of church and say, church, don't listen to what they say, be still and see the glory of the Lord. Now watch this power. What are you going to do? You're going to boo me out of the thing, or are you going to say, okay, I'm ready to stand and see, be quiet, and the fear's gone, I don't have to be afraid anymore? What did Moses have that gave him the backing or the courage to stand in front of 2.5 million people and say that?
Well, they did have the pillar of cloud and fire. That was true.
Yes, he had the pillar of cloud and fire. It didn't say the pillar was gone.
Right.
So during the day, that pillar is still there, which means that God's presence is still with his people.
Correct.
And the people are up in a roar about that. God's presence is still there with them, and they're still up in an uproar. And then you had the fire, the cloud of fire at night that they could physically see. But there's something else that Moses had. Moses had all the plagues that God had done, everything up until that point, to deliver them from 400 years of slavery out of the hand of the Egyptians. He saw God's power. They saw God's power. And yet there's still sometimes that we do this. We know God's power. We've seen God do things great in our lives, answer to prayer, healings, people coming to know the deliverer, things like that that we've seen. And sometimes when we get into, like I was Tuesday, get in this thing where something in the battle just seems so heavy that, I just want to give up. I'm just like the Israelites. No difference.
And so I would think that Moses would have faith in God that he was going to do what he said.
Yeah. So Moses, and God spoke to Moses and told him, I'm going to do
but
this.
As a person listening,
Yeah, it's sometimes hard, right?
Yes.
It would be hard. It would be hard to hear that. I think I would probably be with the majority of the Israelites. I don't know that I would have been on Moses' side, when you hear that Pharaoh's coming with 600 chariots. And you got to imagine, you're stuck up against the sea, and you turn back and you see a 600 chariots is going to cut up a cloud of dust. Mm-hmm. That looks like a thunderstorm or a storm or a tornado coming across the thing. I mean, that's going to be a pretty massive army coming. And they're going to be coming pretty quick, I would think. So we go to verse 13 and 14. What does verse 13 and 14? Oh, we already read that. We just read that. So they're trapped up against there. What does this else tell you when you're trapped up against the wall? Who is the only one that can save you? God, right. God is the only one that can save us. There's nothing else, and nothing that we can do that can save ourselves. They couldn't do nothing in this situation. Again, a good picture of expression of the deliverer coming. So now verses 15 through 16. Let's see what happens.
And Jehovah said unto Moses, wherefore criest thou unto me? Speak unto the children of Israel that they go forward. And lift thou up thy rod, and stretch out thy hand over the sea, and I will divide it, and the children of Israel shall go into the midst of the sea on dry ground.
So you get this picture of Moses crying out to God, and he's like telling Moses, why are you crying out to me? Come on, Moses, just make it happen. Yeah, God, I can't go anywhere. The Red Sea's right here, and there are Egyptian armies coming behind me. Come on, God, really help. And God's just basically telling him, Moses, you got this. Go ahead. Stand up and fight. Don't, get going. And what does he tell him to do?
Hold his rod up.
Yes, pick your staff up, raise your hand over the sea, divide the water so the Israelites can walk through it on middle ground. Now, God goes and takes that. So, remember, in the beginning, the entire earth, back in creation, was covered with what? Water, remember? And the Spirit was hovering over the waters before God formed, took and made the firmament, right? So all the way back in the beginning, we have that. And God did what? He caused the waters to recede, right? Or go back. And when the flood happened, we had the whole earth covered with water again. And here we have these stories. They would have been told all this about God splitting the waters, dividing it. And here he is doing the same thing in this story. He's telling Moses, raise your arm up over top, and then the water goes back and splits. Now, I don't know how wide it splits. We get this picture in the movies, the water splitting, walls of water on both sides. I have no idea how far the water splits, but it doesn't split. And when you have water, I noticed it coming in the parking lot here on the right there, where the water sits in that stony area. You can kind of still see the discoloration. And when water just dries up, it's not immediately dry, right? It's muddy.
Right.
So no, in this situation, it says you're going to walk through on dry land.
Right.
Which means that God took that water, stood it upright, moved it, split it wide open, and the land became dry. Just like that. There's nothing that can happen. There's nothing, nobody could do anything like that. John, could you do that? Why don't you go do that tomorrow? I'd say go to the pond and say to the pond, split wide open and be dry and walk across it. Yeah, well, that takes the sovereign God that we serve and his powerful power that can do something like that.
And that many people, it had to be pretty wide.
It had to be pretty wide. I mean, either wide or was a short enough area that they could get across it pretty quick, because
right.
It would take 2.5 million people a while to get through the Red Sea.
Sure. Yeah.
On dry land. So you have that.
Well, even from the map, it looks like it was wide.
It was, yeah. Either spot.
A decent amount of water between mm-hmm. where they crossed.
Yeah.
It probably wasn't very wide either.
And I often wondered, is this the same when God, when the waters split? You know, the Bible doesn't tell us that, but it says in the creation that when God's Spirit was hovering over the waters. And the word hovering is like brooding, like a chicken over her chicks, her wings covering. So brooding over the water. So God's Spirit was brooding over the waters. It was hovering over the waters. I wonder if when Moses did that, did the Holy Spirit, which is the breath of air, our breath means breathed across it, and he's the one who dried it out. I don't know that. I couldn't prove that. But let me flip over to Psalms 147, 15 through 18 real quick, and I want to just read to you what this says, 15 through 18. He sends his orders to the world. How swiftly his word flies. He sends the snow like white wool, and he scatters the frost upon the ground like ashes. He hurls the hail like stones. Who can stand against his freezing cold? Then at his command all melts. He sends his winds and the ice thaws. He reveals his word to Jacob, his decrees and regulations to Israel. He has not done this for any other nation. They do not know his regulations. God knew that the children of Israel were backed up, and he knew that the proud, stubborn Egyptians would continue to press on, that they were going to continue to keep on, even though the Israelites were across. Someone grab 19 through 22, and let's see what happens. We know what happens in the story, but let's read what it says. All right.
19.
Yeah, verse 19 through 22.
Then the angel of God, who has been leading the people of Israel, moved to the rear of the camp. The pillar of cloud also moved from the front and stood behind them. The cloud settled between the Egyptian and the Israelite camps. As darkness fell, the cloud turned to fire, lighting up the night. But the Egyptians and Israelites did not approach each other all night. Then Moses raised his hand over the sea, and the Lord opened up a path through the water with a strong east wind. The wind blew all that night, turning the seabed into dry land. So the people of Israel walked through the middle of the sea on dry ground, with walls of water on each side.
Mm-hmm. So the strong east wind comes and dries everything up all night long. You just have this blowing, and the wind waves are way up here. You know, lots of walls on either side. What happened in verse 20? It says that what took place in verse 20? The cloud did what?
It became fire.
Yeah, it set up between though. Did it go out in front of them, or did it move to the back of them?
Move to the back.
So, it's in Psalms 23, it says, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil," right? And in order to have a shadow, what do you have to have behind you? You have to have a light behind you, right? To have to cast a shadow out in the front. I never noticed that before until someone was reading that one time, and they pointed out that, hey, you know, when you put the armor of God on the front, every piece of armor that is out is on in the front of you, but there's not a piece of armor that's listed for the back. Yeah, okay, that's very interesting. Why? Because who's got your back? God does. God has your back. God has the back of the Israelites. He put it in between. Here's the pillar, the cloud, and the light in between it. I just thought that was a very interesting thing. That's not part of the lesson, so that was free. But you have this thing, so God does this. And then 23 through 25, someone grab that one. All the Israelites are on the other side now, and let's see what happens.
And the Egyptians pursued and went after them in the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots and his horsemen. Now it came to pass in the morning watch that the Lord looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of the fire and cloud, and he troubled the army of the Egyptians. And he took off their chariot wheels, so that he drove with them with difficulty. And the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians."
All right, here comes the pillar of cloud, and he sees that, and the they see the Israelites, oh, they got it across, so they begin to just crash, bullheaded straight into the ocean. It's all dry and everything, it gets in there, and God begins to throw all kinds of confusion onto them. And he, you know, causes their wheels to have issues and problems, and they begin to say, well, let's get away from this God. Should have thought about that when you had 10 plagues on you before, and you lost all your firstborns, and now you're pursuing after the same people that you freed from, like their God freed them from. And what in the world made you think you can go against this God? Especially when you see a pillar of fire that stands in front of you. I just don't get it. The pride of the Egyptians was so great that they just figured their hearts and hardened. God allowed their hearts to be hardened and craziness.
Maybe they were thinking that their gods were better.
It could have been. I don't know. I mean, it's just absolutely crazy to think that way. I mean, would you think like that, Michael?
Well, I'm just thinking military. You just do what you do. You do what you're told.
In the military, you do what you're told. Right. And so Pharaoh orders all the soldiers in there to do that. But, you know, they've got to think this Pharaoh is insane. You know, he's a nut. I mean, he's really a nut. And they realize it and they begin. And what did they do? They said, "That's the Lord. The Lord is fighting for them against Egypt." That was their cry. The Lord is fighting for them against Egypt. 26 through 29 says this. When all the Israelites had reached the other side, the Lord said to Moses, "Raise your hand back over the sea again. Then the waters will rush back and cover the Egyptians and their chariots and charioteers. So as the sun began to rise." Now you got to picture this. This is, they've crossed through the night because the sun is rising. So you have this, you know what sunrises are. They're beautiful, right? So you have this sun rising across the Red Sea, and it's rising, and Moses raises his hand again over the sea, and the water begins to go back into its place. The Egyptians tried to escape, and the Lord swept them into the sea. The waters returned and covered all the chariots, charioteers, the entire army of Pharaoh, all the Egyptians who had chased the Israelites into the sea. Not a single one survived. That's the other difference in the movie. You have Pharaoh who stands on the back shore and is spared. That's not how the scripture says. It says not a single Egyptian who charged into that sea or pursued after the Israelites was alive. So maybe Pharaoh did stand back. Maybe he didn't go in. I don't know. But the Bible says that nothing. Not
so
one.
How long was the sea parted then?
It says throughout the evening, throughout the night.
You did it during the day previous, mm-hmm. Right?
Right. And then throughout the night they crossed and... Yeah, it doesn't tell us how many days this took for them to cross it either. It could have been multiple days.
Right.
But it says that as it rose, they pursued into it. When you get this picture of God, and while you think about this, we'll answer this. What should we learn from Pharaoh, from this story? Well, I turn to Hebrews 10. He didn't get it, right?
He didn't get the presence of God. Like, he didn't get how powerful God was.
He didn't get how powerful God was? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, because he did lose his son.
Mm-hmm.
His city. You know, all the people. And like you said, God hardened his heart.
Mm-hmm. And God did it for a purpose. He wanted all the nations, and he wanted his name to be brought glory
right
through this. I want you to think about this too. Hebrews 10:31 says this. It is a terrible thing to fall into the hands of the living God. The previous verse says this. For we know the one who said, "I will take revenge, I will repay, saith the Lord." And then it says, it is a terrible thing to fall into the hands of the living God.
You meant what he said.
When God says something, it takes place. And there is nothing when we go back to, if you think back over the first few lessons, when God said to Adam and Eve, you eat of this fruit, the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, right? You eat of that tree, you will what?
Certainly die.
You will certainly die. And God said that, and that took place. When God said to the people around Noah, if you don't repent, Noah preached repentance for 120 years, or in that range is what we came up with from the scriptures. He said, repent. If you don't repent, you will
perish.
You're going to perish, right? There's going to be a big flood. He told the children of it, told the children of Egypt, you know, listen, if you don't let my people go, I'm going to send all these plagues. And he sent these plagues, let my people go, over and over again. So we have this pattern throughout the first few books of the Bible here, the first early histories, the first 1500 years on creation, on earth, where God says something, and he says that. And then in Hebrews, you get this verse, it is a terrible thing to fall into the hands of a living God. The Lord destroyed all the Egyptians, the Egyptian army, but he saved the Israelites alive. Someone grab Exodus 14, 30 to 31. And we are getting close to the end of the chapter here before we move on.
Thus Jehovah saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead upon the seashore. And Israel saw the great work which Jehovah did upon the Egyptians, and the people feared Jehovah, and they believed in him and in his servant Moses.
Hmm.
Seeing is believing.
Seeing is believing. The Egyptians had refused to believe what God had written, what God had said. The same thing for us today. If we refuse to forgive, we refuse to believe what God has given to us, we too will fall through the judgment, just like the children, the Egyptian children, the army. The Bible is God's voice to us today. Through his Holy Spirit, he speaks, and we should take heed of that. Children of the Egyptian people did not. But you think that would solve the Israelites' problem? No. Flip over to chapter 16, 1 through 3.
And they journeyed from Elam, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elam and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they departed from the land of Egypt. Then the whole congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said to them, oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, and when we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out of this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger.
Few verses before that, they were just praising God, singing a great song of victory. And then Moses leads them out, and they begin to complain because they don't have any water, and they get to a place called Marah, and that water that was there was bitter to drink. And so they complained to Moses about that, and turned against Moses and said that, and Moses took a piece of wood and threw it into the water, and it made the water turn into a sweet water so they could drink it. And now they get out there and they say, oh, we don't have any meat. We're eating nothing but this unleavened bread, or bread that we don't have. You know, they just wanted some meat. You know, yeah. Sometimes we want to do that too. Yeah, they were having manna, right? So they had this. It was like a sweet cake, like a frost that came on the ground. And so God's, sitting there complaining about all this food that they don't have, and that God had given to them. And so here they are. This is where they begin to complain about the thing. But just a few little ways earlier, they were saying, we believe in this God that can free us from the Egyptians, and we believe by the power of God it happened. Don't you think God could provide your food for them? Don't we do that? Yeah, we do that. Or at least I do. Yeah, God's able to provide. Well, let's see what happens. Who did they blame for the situation, first of all?
Moses
and Aaron. You led us out here into the wilderness to die again. Same thing they said when the Egyptians were chasing them, right? You led us out here. They didn't blame God. They blamed Moses and Aaron, but God's the one who delivered them. And Moses is just a servant.
It seems like human nature, how quickly we forget.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very easy to forget.
Right.
I wish I knew what they were... It's very interesting you said that. It's very quick to forget. Sometimes God does something great for us. He answers a prayer, and we get excited about that, just like they did. And then, no sooner than a week or two later, you forgot all about it. And you're like, what in the world? 11 through 12 says this. Then the Lord said to Moses, I have heard the Israelites' complaints. Now tell them, in the evening you will have meat to eat, and in the morning you will have all the bread you want. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God. So in the evening you're going to have meat, and in the morning they're going to have bread. They didn't deserve anything. God in his mercy said, hey, I'm going to promise you meat in the evening and bread in the morning. That's what he said. So it's a promise, right? God's merciful, even though they didn't deserve anything. Remember the thing. Mercy is this, and grace is this. We'll get to it. We're going to put it up here on the screen. 16 verses 13 through 16. Someone got that? That evening, the vast number of quails flew in and covered the camp. Just imagine this. The next morning, the area of the camp was wet with dew. When the dew evaporated, a flaky substance as fine as a frosted blanket covered the ground. The Israelites were puzzled when they saw it. What is it? They asked each other. They had no idea what it was. They had seen anything like this before. And Moses told them, it is food the Lord has given you to eat. These are the Lord's instructions. Each household should gather as much as it needs. Pick up 2 quarts for each person in your tent. So he gave specific instructions on how much to pick up. Since the Israelites were unable to provide food for themselves, God was merciful and helped them be helpless. We had this with Adam and Eve when they could not provide their own clothes. What did God do? He was merciful and gave them clothes, right? He had this for Noah, correct? He provided a boat. And through Noah, he said, build a boat. No one deserves God's mercy, but to whom is his mercy available? So if no one deserves God's mercy, to whom is his mercy available? Do you deserve God's mercy? I don't. So who is it available to?
Whoever believes.
Ah, to whoever comes to him in faith, or to whoever believes, right? We have to come to him first and believe. And verse 35, skip all the way down to verse 35. You got some situations that take place there when people don't listen. You would think that takes place, right? So the people of Israel ate the manna for 40 years until they arrived at the land where they would settle. They ate manna until they came to the border or the land of Canaan. 40 years, you have the same breakfast every morning. Anybody here ever eat oatmeal over and over and over as a kid?
All I can say is it was a
What does that say about God's faithfulness? God is, when he says he's going to do something, he provided for 40 years. I didn't do any math, but if someone's got a calculator on it, take 365 days times 40, how many days is that? Anybody got a calculator real quick?
20,000.
How many days is that?
14,600.
14,600 days. Every morning you wake up, the dew is on the ground, and there is your breakfast. Your bread for the day. And then at night, the quail comes and floods the ground, and you go out and get your fresh meat. For 14,600 days, God did that for 40 years.
But then they complained about that.
Ah, they didn't stop there. You think they would be great, right? I woke up this morning and, son, look what God provided for us today.
Because we'll have a new tent and start grazing.
Exactly. Look what he provided for us tonight for dinner. Your mom didn't have to go shopping. The food came right to the front door. You talk about food delivery service today in our world. That was the best food delivery service ever. God invented it.
That's a lot of feathers.
It's a lot of feathers.
A lot of feathers.
Yeah, a lot of feathers. So you have this. You have this. And I can imagine someone like myself or someone, maybe not like myself, or someone who's got a mind of entrepreneurship said, hey, I think I'll just collect 350 of these. I'll start plucking the feathers off of the birds and I'll start making stuffed pillows.
Right.
Yeah.
That's not what God said, though. God said, what happens? You take only for what you need, right? He wouldn't allow that.
The verse that said some gathered more, some gathered less, but they had... The people that gathered more were...
Yeah, that like on bread...
They were, or whatever.
Yep, exactly. And there were some who gathered too much, and then the bread molded. And you got complained, why? Because you took too much. You weren't supposed to take that much. So, there is that whole thing. So, let's think the Israelites figured it out. They got it all together. The fathers have taught their children 40 years later now. We got a group of kids coming up, and they all learn that God is God, and when he says something, it's good, and he's merciful to us, and, it doesn't happen. Let's see what happens in 17, verses 1 through 4. It says, at the Lord's command, the whole community of Israel left the wilderness of Sin and moved from place to place, eventually camped at Rephidim. But there was no water for there the people to drink. So once more, the people complained against Moses. Give us water to drink, they demanded. Moses hollers out, quiet! Why are you complaining against me, and why are you testing the Lord? But tormented by thirst, they continued to argue with Moses. Why did you bring us out of Egypt? Are you trying to kill us and our children and livestock of thirst? Then Moses cried out to the Lord, what should I do with these people? They are ready to stone me.
Such 80 people.
Yeah, we're right. Man, I tell you, come on, Lord, what is going on? And so, on the basis of what they learned about God so far, why was God worthy to be trusted to help the Israelites in this need?
Say that again.
On the basis of what we just learned about all the things that God has provided for them, why was God worthy to be trusted to help the Israelites with this specific need?
Because he provided for them all up to that point.
For 40 years he provided for their food and for meat and bread, right? So God provides water for them, right? He gives them water here. Verse 5 through 6, let's see what happens. And so, even though they didn't deserve God's help, he was not going to let his chosen people, they kept losing the fact that the deliverer was going to come through their line. They didn't know who's going to have the deliverer. They didn't know which family, which line was going to have the deliverer. But the deliverer was going to come through the line. So God's going to preserve his people. They kept forgetting that over and over again. I forget that. That God says, I preserve you. You are my son. You are a chosen people, and Peter, and a royal priesthood, a holy nation. He has preserved us as followers of him. The same thing. Even though they did not deserve God's help, he wouldn't let his chosen people die of thirst. He was once again demonstrating his mercy and his faithfulness to carrying out what he was going to do. Let's see what it says in verse 5 through 6. The Lord said to Moses, walk out in front of the people, take your staff, the one you used when you struck the water of the Nile, and call some of the elders of Israel to join you. I will stand before you on the rock at Mount Sinai. Strike the rock and water will come gushing out. Then the people will be able to drink. So Moses struck the rock as he was told, and water gushed out as the elders looked on. Moses had to do exactly what God said, right? Exactly. God said, strike the rock. He had to strike it. And God showed up.
So,
but, go ahead.
It had to be a very big rock. God said he will stand on it. What does he mean by that?
Strike the rock, the water come out. Then Moses said, Moses struck the rock.
To verse 6. I will stand before you on the rock.
Ah, Mount Sinai. I will stand before you. I wonder what stood. What do you think was standing on the rock? Well, because no man can see God or he will die, right?
Right.
We know that. Right, we'll get to that when it gets to Exodus, when he gives the Ten Commandments. Moses asks to see, Lord, let show me your glory. Let me see you. And God says, all right, I will pass before you, and you will see my backside, but you will not see my face. Okay, we'll get to that story in a few weeks. But when we see that, so when you say that God stood on the rock, I will stand before you on the rock, what do you think was standing over the rock?
The pillar.
Ah, the pillar. I would assume it was the pillar. But, I mean, it doesn't say that here. But somehow, some shape or form, the presence of God came down over that rock and stood there in place. What it was, we don't know, but the pillar was with them when they led them out of there.
And it said he gathered the elders. So Moses was the leader of it all, but
from the tribes.
Mm-hmm. Into tribes, yep. And their elders, and all the complaints come through them to Moses.
To Moses. So he's gathering the leaders of, you know, who he had set up, or those who were in charge of their family, the heads of their households. Elder in the Old Testament usually refers to someone who had a gray head who was older, an older generation who looked up. So don't laugh at me, Crystal, because I have a gray head. So you have this. In 17:6, so Moses strikes the rock, and the water gushed out as the elders looked on. Why do you think God had him summon the elders?
So they can bear witness to that too?
Ah,
and
yes.
Tell the rest.
Yes, your children is passed on, right? To the third, fourth generation. People, we pass on things. We tell our kids about our grandparents. You know, grandpa served in World War II. So yeah, this is what the war was like. You know, we pass that on. And so my son will pass that on to his. Hey, you know, your great-great-grandfather was in World War II when they study in history. We pass on these things. Like the great things that I have done. I remember things that God did for my father and mother in the ministry. As a kid, I will tell my kids, you know, Grandma and Grandpa had this happen to them while they were in the ministry. Things like that, the things that God's delivered us from, we tell our children, hey, God freed me from this. And then they will kind of pass that on. You know, God, our God is so great that he did this for Grandpa, you know, as they go. And that's one of the reasons why they did that. 2.5 million Israelites just got full of water. They had plenty of water, right? All because of that. Now, what do you think happened? Children of Israel were great, and they were just, they got their fresh water and praising God. Thank you, God, for what took place, right? Okay. Psalms 105:41 says this, that God gave the Israelites food and water even though they didn't deserve it. Let me read Psalms 105:41. 105:41 says this. In closing. They asked for meat, and he sent them quail. He satisfied them with hunger for manna and bread from heaven. He split open a rock and water gushed out and formed a river through a dry wasteland. For he remembered his sacred promise to his servant Abraham. So he brought his people out of Egypt with joy. Even though God didn't ask from them anything in return, the children of Israel, when they complained over and over again, God still provided and showed up for them. Did the Israelites work for their food and water? They didn't do anything, right? Did they have to pay for it? No. No person deserves God's love and mercy. We don't deserve it. Even the children of Israel did not deserve God's love and mercy. So here, remember this definition. Grace, God hereby gives sinners what we don't deserve. And then mercy, God hereby does not give sinners what we do deserve. Those children of Israel deserve to die for their complaining. They didn't deserve God's food and water. But God gives them what they didn't deserve. He gave them what they didn't deserve.
Though I would imagine with that volume of people that there were births, there were deaths.
Mm-hmm. Along the way.
Along the way, too.
Yeah, there would have been births, there would have been deaths, there would have been those who, for 40 years, who would have might have been too old and not made the journey so far in the wilderness.
Right.
But then they also had the bones of Joseph, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they took the bones of Joseph with them to bury them in the promised land. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when you think about this here, and I want you to get that picture. Grace, God hereby gives sinners what we don't deserve. That's just one form of grace. The short version that a lot of people say is unmerited favor. I personally like to look at grace as God's unmerited favor. However, the divine influence upon you and my's heart, and then its reflection out of our life. So that's true grace. Grace, when God truly gives us grace, that is a divine influence that comes into each one of our lives. It's only through Him. And then out of that, we reflect His grace to others. We're a reflection of who God is through that. But in essence, God gives sinners what we don't deserve. So far, we are here on the timeline. We are a little over 1,500 years B.C., Exodus. We're in the Exodus part now. And next week we will pick up where God makes an agreement with the children of Israel as long as they obey Him. And that is going to be a fun one, because have you ever made an agreement with your kids? If you do this, you will get this. Or if you complete your school to work tomorrow, you can have your friends over. Or, have you ever done that? Well, God does this with the children of Israel.
Right. Before He can even give it, they got messed up.
Exactly. So we're going to see that. We're going to be talking about that. Again, what God does with next week. So it'll be exciting.